Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The World Health Organization has just released an alarming report. It says by 2050, antibiotic resistance could cause 10 million deaths each year. In the first part of this program, we'll want to check in with a number of Iowa researchers, medical professionals about the worldwide threat of increasing resistance to antibiotics, and also a link you may not know of, the role livestock production plays in that increase. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org or tweet Iowa Public Radio. Joining us, Michael Pentella is director of the State Hygienic Laboratory. He's also clinical professor at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben.
Also joining us by phone, Dr. Caitlin Pedotti is medical director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Dr. Pedotti, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And in our AIM studio, Dr. Kristen Obink is associate director of the National Institute of Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education. That's quite a mouthful. Thank you, Dr. Obink, for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the problem. Have you all sort of elucidate the problem for us, the WHO report that was just released, said could cause 10 million deaths each year. Dr. Pedotti, would you start us off by giving us your reaction to that report and telling us some details that we should know about?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. You know, the recent report, I think, is highlighting an issue that, you know, we've been aware of as a growing concern in public health, in medicine, you know, sort of across the board for some time now. You know, the CDC has shared that in the U.S. it's estimated that about 2 million people each year are infected with a resistant organism, and there's about 23,000 people who die as a result. And unfortunately, you know, this includes many different types of bacteria, and as we've been seeing, even some types of fungus like Candida auris. So this is a concern. And in fact, you know, one of the things that sort of helped call this to light and start getting people talking was actually something called the Antimicrobial Resistance Challenge that was led by CDC starting last fall. And this has been sort of an effort to get people from all over the country, all over the world, really, to collaborate on this issue and start thinking about what we can do. And one of the things that I think is really great about Iowa is that you actually have three of us here, Dr. Pentella, Dr. Obink, and myself, representing sort of three different areas. And we all were able to come together and make a commitment as part of that antimicrobial challenge to work together to kind of figure out what's going on in Iowa and how we might best protect Iowans here. So I do think that this is a good example of how this approach is really going to have to be multidisciplinary, and that's the approach we're trying to take here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Michael Pentella, explain a little bit more about how this happens, how we get this antibiotic resistance. How does it develop?
Well, there's several ways in which it can develop. And when you look at the organisms themselves, they have ways to fight back so that they can reproduce themselves and survive. So at the genetic level, they are able to develop resistance, and they can share it with each other. So different organisms share different genes so that they can be resistant. So a number of different ways in which they form resistance to antibiotics, depending on the organism. For example, they can change their surface proteins so that the antibiotics can't enter as well. Or they can produce an enzyme that will inactivate an antibiotic. Some of them have efflux pumps that allow them to pump out the antibiotic that enters their cell. Mm. So there's a number of different ways that they fight back.
Mm. Quite amazing creatures. How fast can they do this? How many generations does it take?
Well, bacteria go back around 3.5 billion years in existence, and they reproduce themselves generally in the 20-minute time frame. So 15 to 20 minutes, you have a new organism that develops. So they're very fast. much faster than we are.
Okay. Dr. Kristen Obink, give us your reaction to the WHO report. What called attention to it from your perspective at the National Institute of Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education?
Sure. So these numbers certainly are alarming, and we've been seeing those types of alarming numbers for some time now when it comes to antimicrobial resistance. Our institute truly takes what we call a one health approach, or trying to bring human, animal, and environmental health together. Just as Dr. Padotti mentioned, we're all working together here in the state of Iowa and then also on the national and even international level to convene all of these different groups working in this space to leverage resources and come up with some better solutions that are truly going to have an impact on this big challenge that we have ahead of us.
Dr. Obink, I think you're the one who can elaborate on the link to livestock production. What is the link?
Sure. So just as antibiotics are used in human medicine, they're also important to veterinary medicine as well, both in companion animals and food animals. But because, of course, food animals are eaten by humans, we look at that a little bit differently than we do in our companion animal population. And so animals become sick just like humans do, and some of the antibiotics that we use in food-producing animals are also used in human medicine and are important to human health as well. And we call those medically important antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's also because of the way we raise our livestock, right? They're in fairly crowded areas, more crowded than we are, say, as humans, right?
Sure, and certainly some livestock production can be that way. It depends on the species, depends on the method of how the animals are being raised. But that does present some challenges, also presents us with some capacity to have some control over the health of those animals. For example, in our hog facilities, we have control over temperature and things that we can do to prevent stress from the animals and keep them healthier so that we use less antibiotics. But certainly when we do have animals in closed spaces, this does present us with some challenges as well that we are learning more about how to address appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Obink, people would want to know, we have this connection with production of livestock. Does that mean we are more susceptible to it as individuals when we eat livestock that has been treated with antibiotics?
Sure. So we in our country have the world's safest food supply. There are a lot of regulatory processes in place that ensure that even when an animal is treated with antibiotics, that does not end up in our food. For example, animals that are given antibiotics are not allowed to be slaughtered for a certain period of time after they're given those antibiotics so that we don't see those in our meat and in our milk. So we truly do take a lot of precautions in this country to keep that from happening.
So there are no traces of those antibiotics when we have this period of time pass?
Certainly, this is monitored very closely, and so if there does happen to be traces found, which is very rare, that food is pulled from the food supply. But certainly these are challenges that are ongoing. That being said, there are regulatory processes in place to prevent that in our country.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Padotti, perhaps you can go, while we're still talking about the impact here, how widespread this is. Are there certain diseases, ailments that we're seeing more impacted by these antibiotic-resistant organisms than others?
Yeah, sure. You know, when you think about infections due to resistant organisms, it's a little bit complicated, right? Because a resistant bacteria or fungus could cause a variety of different symptoms or clinical pictures. So we do see sort of a range of the specific illnesses that are caused. But for example, one of the things that we've been looking at closely and one of the things that is a reportable illness here in Iowa is something called a carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. So Enterobacteriaceae is the group of bacteria, and we're saying that if people are finding that this group is resistant to carbapenems, which are a pretty broad spectrum, heavy class of antibiotics, we want you to talk to us about it at the health department. Now, the reason is because, and of course, Dr. Pantelic can probably elaborate more than I can on this, but the way that this resistance can develop in these organisms, it can sometimes be something that just happens and makes the one bacteria resistant, something that's isolated to the organism itself. Or it could be something that we call sort of a more mobile plasmid. So by that I mean that there's now something that different bacteria could learn, and it could teach other bacteria how to develop a similar kind of resistance. And of course, that's concerning because now it's not just the spread, from person to person, but from bacteria to bacteria. And as you heard from Dr. Pantella, you know, in a relatively short period of time, if you think about the fact that we've only had penicillin for 80, 90 years, we've seen the development of some pretty significant resistance. So these organisms are smart. And when we think about trying to find ways to address this, I really do think we have to be thinking broadly about all of these pieces here, which again is why people like the three of us and many more come together to try and look at this from a variety of angles.
Mm-hmm. Michael Pantella, do you want to elaborate on that? Going back to how fast this is occurring, when we say a generation of these bacteria might be 20 minutes, whereas humans, we generally think of a generation as 20 years, right? So this is just incredibly speeded up. And if you could talk to what Dr. Obink spoke to, the connection with livestock as you see it.
The first part of the question is about the antibiotic and the resistance developing. We've been using antibiotics since the 1940s, and we were very fortunate from the 1950s to 1970s, there's been many different classes of antibiotics developed and made available for use. That pipeline of antibiotics has slowed down dramatically in the last few years. So there's not as many new antibiotics coming out. So the organisms are getting more used to the antibiotics that we're using more frequently now. As far as in the animals, I've been focusing more on public health in the last few years, so I'll leave that up to Dr. Obik.
Okay. Very good. Okay, so let's talk about who can talk about our treatment, keeping with the livestock. Perhaps Dr. Pedotti, you can weigh in on this too. Are there things, and Dr. Obink as well, things we can do differently with our livestock to slow this development of resistance down?
Yeah, so I guess in terms of livestock, again, Dr. Obink is probably the most well-positioned of the three of us to speak to that specifically. But as Dr. Pantella said, he and I work pretty closely on the public health side.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the work that we're doing together, we rely on our colleagues, Dr. Pantella, in the laboratory to help us find these resistant organisms quickly. And so when they're detected in a laboratory setting, part of the support that we provide from the public health or health department side is we work with facilities, with patients, to try and understand two things. First, when we can, we try and understand what the risk factors were and how we think that somebody might have acquired these organisms. Now, risk factors for something like this include things like recent antibiotic use, contact with the healthcare system, and particularly contact with a healthcare system outside of the United States. And so those are things that we think about and ask for, just like we do an investigation for any kind of diseases that we follow on the health department side here. Now, we're not always able to find an exact single risk factor to explain things, but it helps us understand things a little better. But what's more important is we try and offer places support in containing these organisms so that they don't spread. And a lot of that might sound a little bit basic, things like doing good hand washing, things like, when appropriate, using gloves and gowns. But we try and work pretty closely with places to look at procedures and find ways that we might help them to sort of control the spread of things from one person to the next. And so all of the things I've sort of just described are things that you do in response to identifying an issue, right? But in public health, where we really want to be is on the preventive side. And so when we think about ways to sort of prevent the development of these kinds of things, that's when we get into thinking about the use of these tools, these antibiotics, to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us on the human side, that's really, we call that antibiotic stewardship, making sure that we're using the right medication for the right patient at the right time. And again, we really try from the health department side to support our clinicians, our facilities, our providers on accessing good resources and being able to use those tools carefully so that we don't lose the use of them. And I would also say there's a role just for all of us as the general public to play in that, recognizing that antibiotics are great when they're for the right thing, but that there are many things that antibiotics can't be used for, things like viral illnesses that you don't need a medication for. And so keeping that in mind when you visit your physician, and also, you know, being informed, and when you do get an antibiotic, making sure that you understand why you're getting it, what you're getting it for, and how you should be taking it are all really important things for people to do.
So, Dr. Pedotti, even with your primary care physician, it sounds like you could, you know, if you're prescribed an antibiotic, what would be a good question just to double check that you're not overusing the antibiotic? You could ask what, for instance?
Yeah, I might say, you know, thank you so much, doc. Can you describe for me what it is I'm taking this medication for? And can you make sure that I understand how to take it and how long? And also think about the side effects that you might encounter. You know, all medications, all treatments have their benefits and their risks, right? Antibiotics are no different. And they're great when they're used appropriately, but we want to encourage everybody to make sure that we're using the right medication for the right person at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Michael Pentella, I wonder if you can sort of give us an example of illnesses that people might come in. Dr. Pedotti said, you know, you want to investigate. Are there people who come in who have a set of symptoms that is that red flags them? Perhaps they've been given an antibiotic. They don't respond to it. Is that when a red flag goes up?
That, in some cases, that will be the red flag, that a person was given an antibiotic for an infection and they did not recover in the time frame that they should. And so they call their physician again, and they may need to prescribe a different antibiotic for that infection. One of the ones the CDC is most concerned about that occurs is Neisseria gonorrhea. If someone doesn't recover their symptoms from gonorrhea, and within the time frame that they're taking the antibiotic, they should contact their physician again. Mm-hmm. But it also occurs with a lot of different infections as well, like Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Someone with TB would be closely monitored, and if they're not recovering, they may have a more resistant strain of TB. But what's occurring simultaneously is the laboratory and the clinical laboratories throughout Iowa and the hospital laboratories, for example, they're doing testing to isolate the pathogen from the various sources. For example, if you have a respiratory infection, you may take a sputum sample, and they'll detect the pathogens in that sputum sample. And then they test them against various antibiotics and report back to the clinician what the organism is susceptible to and what it's resistant to. And the physician makes sure that the patient is on the right antibiotic.
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned it. Yeah, go ahead. Who wants to jump in?
I just wanted to add that it's so important that that's done in a timely fashion, mm-hmm. so that we detect those resistant organisms before they're transmitted to others. As Dr. Pedotti was saying, there's a lot of efforts that need to be done to put prevention measures in place. And so time is essential. And the State Hygienic Lab is here to support those clinical labs in detecting those pathogens.
Dr. Pedotti, as Medical Director of the Iowa Department of Public Health, tell us how widespread this sort of death is. We talked about the WHO report estimating 10 million deaths each year by 2050. What is the current picture in Iowa and across the nation? How many extreme cases have we seen here?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you know, the last data coming out of CDC was suggesting that we see about 23,000 deaths nationally as a result of resistant infections. Now, following some of that can be a little tough sometimes because, as you've heard, the different bacteria, right, that can cause these infections and develop resistance are really quite varied. There's many different types of bacteria, and again, there's even, you know, a fungus or two that we worry about. So it can be a little bit tough to get good numbers, and so some of the estimates that you hear are sort of modeled based off of what we've seen so far. Now, in Iowa, as I mentioned, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae are actually a specific organism that is reportable, meaning the health department is getting information on that. And I can give you a sense of last year, we had 109 reports of CREs, and of those 109, 30 of those had that kind of transmissible resistance ability that I mentioned to you. And so we do follow up on those. And again, you know, we're trying to figure out how we think these things might be occurring, but more importantly, work with facilities to try and keep them from moving to other people. Now, related to this particular resistant bacteria, something else that, you know, has come up, I think, in the news recently and just sort of in general as an organism to watch would be Candida auris, which is the fungus that I mentioned. And unfortunately, over the past, you know, 10 or so years, we've seen the emergence of this pretty resistant fungus that, you know, it is tough to treat and it's tough to get out of an environment once it's gotten into it, you know, meaning like a hospital room or something. It can be tough to clean.
Where does Candida auris, this fungus, come from?
Yeah, you know, it emerged in a couple of places around the world over the past 10 years. And unfortunately, we have seen cases here in the United States, particularly in areas like New York and Illinois. Now, thankfully, we haven't yet detected this here in Iowa, but this is an example of something that we work very closely with our providers and with Dr. Pentella and the State Hygienic Laboratory on. We want our laboratorians to think about this. We want our clinicians to think about this. And this would be an example of something, you know, that if somebody were worried about, had questions about, or thought they had, you know, this is an area that public health would want to be involved to help detect and control.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Padani, we have about a minute before we go to the break. We'll have you back for a few minutes after our break, all three of you. But how up to speed would you say our primary care physicians on this threat and what needs to be done to lessen the threat and to identify the cases that may interest you at the Iowa Department of Public Health?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, you know, that's a reflection of the way that we really have a lot of people from a lot of backgrounds who work together on this. So we work with our local public health partners. We work with infectious disease specialists, primary care physicians, pharmacists, veterinarians. You know, we really work together to share information on these issues. We share that out of the health department through our website, our social media, and a variety of resources that people can reach out to if they want to learn more.
Okay. Please stay with us. We'll be back with our guests this half hour for a few minutes to tie up some loose ends and get their thoughts as we look toward the future. Dr. Caitlin Padotti is the Medical Director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Dr. Kristen Obink, Associate Director of the National Institute of Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education. Michael Pentella, Director of the State Hygienic Laboratory. And we'll be back in just a moment as we talk about antibiotic resistance. After that, do a little politics. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Glad to have you on board in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about antibiotic resistance this hour. Recently, the World Health Organization released a report. It said that by 2050, that's in just over 30 years, their antibiotic resistance could cause 10 million deaths each year around the globe. We're talking with Dr. Caitlin Padotti, Medical Director of the Iowa Department of Public Health. Michael Pentella is Director of the State Hygienic Laboratory, also Clinical Professor at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. And Dr. Kristen Obink, Associate Director of the National Institute of Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Just a few more minutes to talk about this. Perhaps, Michael Pentella, you can do this. Take us back, because most of us grew up only in the time since, of course, penicillin was around. What was it like before we had antibiotics? What was health fighting disease like?
Very difficult. If you think back to the start of the 20th century, there was not antibiotics available. And the causes of death, the top causes of death were TB, pneumonia, diarrhea, and that was followed by heart disease, liver disease. By the year 2000, heart disease, cancer, stroke are the leading causes of death in the United States. And that really has a lot to do with the success of antibiotics. But it's not antibiotics alone. We've seen greatly improved hygiene and sanitation. There's better nutrition and housing, and there's vaccines available as well.
Mm-hmm.
So all four of those work together.
Right. With this increasing resistance to antibiotics that these organisms have, I wonder, Michael Patella, if in a certain way we could be going back to the past in having some of the tools removed from our tool bag for fighting these diseases.
Yes, I think that's what the WHO report points out very well, that we could be leaving antibiotics behind and having to deal with these infectious diseases at a greater extent in the future.
Okay, let's go to a caller here. Joe is with us from Davenport. Hi, Joe. Not much time, but time enough for your quick question. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. I was wondering what role antibiotic allergic reactions in patients play in limiting the options that you can prescribe to them, and then if that has any effect on building resistances from the diseases.
Okay, allergic reaction to antibiotics. Of course, that's fairly common, isn't it, Dr. Padati?
I don't know that I would say it's particularly common. It can happen. The class that you probably hear it a lot with is actually the penicillins. And what's interesting about those allergy-mediated processes is that sometimes they can actually get better over time. So there are some patients who, if at one point they did have a reaction, if enough time has passed, years, 8, 10 years, sometimes we actually are able to go back and use those again for that patient. Now, those kinds of decisions have to be made, of course, working very closely with your healthcare provider in a careful setting. But certainly, if there is an individual who has particular allergies, that does further narrow your options from a medication standpoint. It doesn't necessarily directly contribute to resistance, but if it's a resistant organism, again, it could make it harder to pick the right medication for that patient if you don't have as many choices, which again, I think is why you saw a lot in that World Health Organization report, the descriptions of the need for continuing to develop new tools, using the tools we have thoughtfully right now, but also the need for continuing to develop new medications.
Okay. Yeah, let's go to that point of new medications. Dr. Padati, you start there first. Why aren't we developing new antibiotics? If this is sort of an arms race where we have something, a tool that works, kills a harmful organism, they develop a resistance to it, so we just have a different tool that we develop. Why aren't we just keeping one step ahead?
Yeah, so, I'm really more on the public health side,
okay,
and not so much
okay
on the medication development side.
Okay.
But I can tell you that developing those new medications, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of resources, and I think what is important is that we all continue to identify the fact that we need to think about this.
Mm-hmm. Michael Pintella, is that something you can speak to?
I agree with Dr. Padati. It's the resources and the time, and we may have exhausted what's readily available and have to come up with new classes of antibiotics, which is even more expensive.
Dr. Obink at the National Institute of Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education, developing new antibiotics. Are you working on facets of that there?
Sure. So we're certainly working with stakeholders that are in that area, such as pharmaceutical companies. One thing I would say to add to what Dr. Padati and Dr. Pintella said is just that if you think about the types of pharmaceutical drugs we see on TV, it's for those chronic diseases, so where you'd be taking them on a daily basis for the rest of your life. And when you think about developing new classes of antibiotics and new antibiotic drugs, from a business standpoint, we're going to want to use those drugs the least amount possible And so from a financial and profitability perspective, it's very hard to make a go of it. And so companies are facing some significant financial and regulatory burdens that make it very difficult to develop new drugs.
Mm-hmm. Do the pharmaceutical companies need some extra incentive support here, perhaps, to do that?
Sure, and that's something that is being looked at by some groups really around the world, but maybe not even so much new incentives, but looking at it from a different perspective. So rather than companies being reimbursed for the use of their drugs, perhaps we need to reimburse them to have access to those drugs. That I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's just one thing that's been thrown out on the table, that perhaps these companies get reimbursed a little bit differently to make it a little more financially possible for them to develop these drugs.
Mm-hmm. Antibiotic resistance, certainly a complicated issue to discuss. Anything before we go from any of the three of you that we need to hear about or you want to emphasize before we go? Jump in.
This is Dr. Obink. I would just comment, again, building on Dr. Padotti and Dr. Pantola's comments earlier when they were talking about the strides that are being made in antibiotic stewardship on the human health side. Mm-hmm. There's very similar things happening on the animal side as well. So looking at alternatives to antibiotics, how can we truly use these drugs more judiciously at the right dose, at the right time, for the right duration, for the right patient?
Mm-hmm. And as far as what individuals can do, Dr. Padotti, when we have antibacterial soap, is that contributing to this problem in any way, or all these other antibacterial products that are household products in the meantime?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I've had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Pantela several times at conferences, and he has some really nice slides where he shows how the infusion of antibiotic products, has really increased. And again, overall, what we're talking about is trying to be careful stewards of the tools that we have. We don't want to overuse things we have because we want them to work when we need them. And so stewardship really is an important part of this. And again, I would echo that, you know, it's good for everybody in the public to be antibiotic aware, to make sure that we understand why we're getting the medications we're getting and how to use them appropriately. And lastly, I would just say that, you know, the health department is always happy to provide information, support, expertise as needed. And so we're always happy to be a resource.
Mm-hmm. Michael Pantela, getting the soap, antibacterial soap example, should people forego that? Do we really need that?
Well, some circumstances you do need it, such as the healthcare environment, and hospitals and clinics, and routine use around the house. If no one's immunocompromised or has a serious infection, it's not really necessary. It is very important, though, to wash your hands regularly. Wash your hands before you prepare meals, and keep good hygienic practices.
Okay, very good. We'll end it there. Michael Pantela, Director of the State Hygienic Laboratory, Dr. Caitlin Padotti, Medical Director of the Iowa Department of Public Health, Dr. Kristen Obink, Associate Director of the National Institute of Antimicrobial Resistance Research and Education. Thank you very much for shedding some light on this very important and very complicated issue. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we have roughly a year and a half to go before the 2020 general election. By reading the politics in online, you would think it was going to be in a couple months. No, it is a year and a half to go before the 2020 general election. Between now and then, of course, the Iowa caucuses in February next year, followed by all those primaries, which will sort out our field of candidates. As we look to 2020, we're still gathering takeaways from the last presidential election, 2016. And one of the questions still being analyzed is, why did Iowa support Donald Trump after voting for president for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012? Well, in 2016, Iowa had more counties flip from Democrat to Republican than any other state. Why? That's what we want to explore right now, because there's a new Iowa State University study looking at this. I'm joined by ISU sociology professors Daniel Creer and Abdi Kuso. They are in our Ames studio. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So tell us, and just jump in where you like here, but what data did you look at specifically?
Well, maybe just to contextualize this just a little bit more. You know, there were only six states that flipped from Obama in 2012 to Trump in 2016. Those six states were Iowa, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida. And of the states that flipped, Iowa's was the largest flip, mm-hmm. An average of about 16 percentage point change in vote for the Republican candidate between 2012 and 2016. There were 206 counties in the country. Of those, 31 of the 206 counties that flipped from Obama, actually voted twice for Obama in 08 and 12, flipped to Trump in 2016. So Iowa was really ground zero for the movement into the Trump vote.
So thank you. To really respond to the initial question, which was, why did Iowa vote for Trump when actually Iowa voted for Obama twice? We looked at variables in three contextual areas. The first one is economic status. There we looked at, for example, median county household income. Mm-hmm. We also looked at adults not working, that is percent of 16 and older not working in the county. And we also looked at employment change, which is county unemployment change from 2007 to 2016. So what you can see there is trying to measure economic impact from three different angles.
Sort of economic anxiety and breaking that apart into different. Okay,
absolutely.
I see. Go ahead.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
And then we looked at geography. Mm-hmm. So in this case, we looked at the extent to which a county is far away from a larger metropolitan area, and that's what's referred to as the rural-urban continuum code, devalued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then we looked at social identities, and this is what we will refer to as social anxiety as well. But that is age, percent county population over 65, and Dan will add to that, this is very important. It's looking at those over 65 because of some earlier assumptions. Education, percent 25 years older with no college degree, and what we refer to whiteness here, percent of non-Hispanic white in the county, and religiosity, the percent of population that attend or that have religious adherence.
So when you looked at it with this data, these factors in mind, what turned out to be the best predictors of changing a Democrat to a Republican in Iowa?
Well, it was interesting. So we really have here the three sort of prevailing explanations in both the academic literature and in journalism. The three were rural-urban divide, right? Mm-hmm. That the polarization between urban and rural is growing. The second is economic anxieties, that those places that felt that they were left behind, where the recession had lingered, where the recovery had been jobless, right? That these are the places where the Trump vote would be largest and the polarization would be greatest. And then the third was the places where there was threatened social identities. And again, we were taking our three sort of regions of variables from the literature and from journalism. What we found was that the largest explanation, the thing that has probably had more news reporting than any other, is economic anxiety. We found that the economic variables were insignificant.
They did not support that.
Right. They had no explanatory weight.
Wow.
And we built our model sort of stepwise. When you looked at them, Abdi can give us more on this, but when you looked at the variables sort of individually or as a group, the economic variables on the surface seemed to be really important. But when you added in rurality and the social identities, we find that the explanatory power went to zero.
So the idea that has been in journalism and in many sectors that mm-hmm. The people who voted against the Democrats were more or less the economic losers of globalization is not correct?
It is not, at least based on our study right now. And I think it looks like, and I think there is something to that point, even from a global point of view, that there is an increased level of identity anxiety that comes from a lot of things. So in this sense, really economic issues measured from three different angles, as I said here, were not significant at all. What was significant was rurality, the extent to which one lives in or a county is far away from a larger metropolitan area, mm-hmm. and the percent of the population that's white. And so in this sense, and education as well. So education is really very important in that those who are more educated were less likely to vote for Trump. So it looks like we're seeing a slow movement from these gut economic fears to more of a social anxiety as such.
So social anxiety that we're not as white as we were as a nation, Abdi?
And we're not exactly sure. I think, honestly, that's in the background, and there has been a lot of discussion about this sort of the racial demographic transformation of the United States as a nation as a whole. And the fascinating thing here is that even if people live in a very highly rural area, and if they have no contact with population of minority individuals, they still react from an identity anxiety level. So the idea is that it's not even exposure to people of a different background, but it is really perceived threat that maybe the nation
not actual
is,
threat, not necessarily actual threat, but perceived threat.
Absolutely.
Right. Through the media, for instance.
Through the media, through journalism, from people talking to each other. It's like in the whole nation's mind in this sense.
Right, and it really is borne out in what you looked at, because you looked at Iowa counties where there is relatively a large amount of immigration, more diverse populations relative to Iowa, and then whiter counties. And what did you find there?
Well, let's take a few examples. So the average county
we've got about two minutes.
So okay.
Maybe you want to
all right, we'll do this really fast. So the average county in Iowa is about 93% white. Mm-hmm. You take a county like Crawford, Steve King, Representative Steve King's home county. That county is actually one of the most diverse counties in Iowa. It's about 74-75% white and about 25% non-white. I think I have the percentage off just a bit. And that county had voted for Obama and then swung strongly to Trump. You take another county, though, like Mitchell County, mm-hmm. where Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders was yesterday in Osage. It's one of the whitest counties in America. It's over 99% white. And that county also had a large swing, about 37.9% actually was the total swing from the vote for Obama to the vote for Trump. So it isn't the fact that you have dark-skinned migrants taking your jobs or moving into your neighborhood that seems to be the dominant factor driving the swing away from a sort of moderate candidate towards a polarizing candidate. It seems to be instead this imagined threat, this perceived threat, this threat to social anxiety.
With a minute or 90 seconds we have left, so quickly spin out some implications here based on what you found.
The implications are such that maybe in the next time around, of course, we cannot discredit or ignore economic issues in general. I think we all react to economic issues in the real sense. But I think the next time around, to a certain degree, the nation itself is changing. And these kinds of threats, real or no real, are sort of leading to a higher level of identity issues, more so than economic issues. So the people who are running next time might be better off to think about identity issues more so than actual economic performance as such.
So Dan Crear, this is good information for people who run campaigns to know.
Yes, it is good information. For what it's worth, I think that the policy that was outlined yesterday by Bernie Sanders, I haven't seen all the details, but it's in the right direction. It's providing rural voters with a narrative for the reasons why their identity is threatened that isn't focused upon migrants or, in other words, it isn't punching down at people who are migrating in or punching out at people who might want to come in. It's instead identifying multinational corporations, farm consolidation, agricultural policies that favor already wealthy agricultural interests, that's the place where the causation for the decline in rural life lies.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we go, with Iowa's big swing here, you identified in this research, well, do you predict Iowa going back to a more moderate stance?
I would say it's very difficult to know. There's a stark choice here, right? Like Representative Steve King has been removed from all of his committees in large part because he's signaling the threat down and out. And it will be interesting to see if the 2020 election rewards someone for doing that, or if it actually does swing back to a moderate position.
Interesting indeed. Dan Creer and Abdi Kuso, sociology professors at Iowa State University. Fascinating research. Thank you for coming into our studio today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Caitlin Harrop. Help today in Ames from Sean McLean. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.